Last time, we explored the theme of equanimity and equanimity practice, how to cultivate equanimity. And I invited people to practice cultivating equanimity in one of a few ways last week. How many of you actually did that or remembered that and stayed with the equanimity practice? Again, equanimity is one of the powerful qualities that can be developed, often considered close to nibbana, close to a sense of the sacred, when the mind can really be equanimous. So a very powerful, wonderful quality to develop. It develops quite naturally with our mindfulness practice. So what I'd like to do today is to, for the first part, review some of what we covered last week. The talk was given entirely in the dark, as some of you may remember, and we don't know what will happen today. The last two talks have been primarily offered in the dark due to power failures, and it could happen again. But I also want, in the second part of the talk, to partly to use the theme of darkness as a metaphor and point to several ways of deepening equanimity practice. So I'll have some of the review in the first part and bring in some of, I think, maybe some quotations and readings that I had prepared but had no way of giving because I could not see them. And I did not have them committed to memory, for the most part. But the second part, I want to deepen that sense of equanimity, and in particular, look to a way of deepening equanimity practice that's very much connected with this time, moving up to the winter solstice, and in a sense, moving into a time of greatest darkness. I'm going to use that as a metaphor to point to ways of practicing equanimity when we're in the dark. And I'll unpack that sense of darkness in a number of ways. In terms of darkness meaning sometimes not knowing, sometimes referring to there being difficulties, but also coming back and seeing the ways that the darkness also, as in the way it is in the natural world, is also generative and fertile. You know, the earth becomes dark, getting ready for more light. So we'll look at that. But it takes equanimity. The earth has a huge amount of equanimity to stay dark, right? How do you think those trees feel being in the darkness? Not much light. A lot of equanimity. If we were in some cultures, we would say that the big redwood trees that are equanimous during the winter are reincarnated bodhisattvas who practiced for a long time. Anyway, I'll go into that some. Okay. So first we looked at the qualities of equanimity. That was the main focus last time. And I mentioned there being a number of qualities that are developed by our equanimity practice. And I talked about several forms of equanimity practice, and they're the ones especially that I mentioned at the beginning of the meditation session. That we can develop equanimity, which really refers to balance, and especially a way of being balanced, wise, and centered increasingly with whatever comes up. You know, this very powerful, important capacity to stay centered. We could use different metaphors: centered, grounded, balanced, increasingly with whatever comes up. And interestingly, again, the way that we develop that is to, first of all, develop the capacity to be balanced with things that are not so difficult. And so we develop mindfulness. We say, can I just be mindful with ordinary thoughts that are not particularly vexing, not particularly difficult? Can I have some sense of balance, grounded, and centeredness just with non-challenging experiences? That's where we start typically with our mindfulness practice. We develop the capacity to be present, to be with what is arising more and more. And part of that is to be less distracted. Part of that is to know our conditioning, know the main forms of our conditioning, our reactivity, and so forth. And we develop, first of all, this general capacity to be more present. And so our ordinary mindfulness practice helps us to cultivate equanimity. But then especially, we develop the equanimity by looking for where we can't be so balanced or centered or grounded. And a lot of equanimity practice is from being with difficult or challenging mind states, body states, emotional states. And again, we especially work with those states where they're in the range where they're not too hard, where they're not too extreme. You know, most of us, all of us could have extreme states occur that would be for us impossible to stay mindful with. And so we actually learn by gradually extending the sense of what's workable. So maybe you started your meditation and when, let's say, anger came up, you just went right into it. It had you. As we develop more mindfulness, maybe gradually you can actually be with anger and it's more workable. And you can actually be mindful and say, okay, I'm angry. I know that. Oh, let me see what it's like in the body. Oh, kind of hot, burning. Oh, let's see what it is in the mind. Oh, I'm forming highly judgmental narratives about this person. This person is bad, wrong, and probably an adherent of a political candidate I don't like. And we can notice that. We start to notice it. So we gradually start bringing in mind states, body states, emotional states that formerly were took us away, right? That we couldn't stay with. And we gradually expand our capacity. And so a big part of developing equanimity is to see where we lose equanimity and to be able to say, let me bring mindfulness. Sometimes it's to bring a kind heart, but let me bring awareness to this state, this difficult state. So it could be being reactive. It could be being angry, sad, fearful, having negative scenarios about some part of my life, whatever. And so a big part of equanimity practice is expanding the range of the workable. And increasingly being able to take challenging situations and find a way of making it, as it were, part of what we can call our practice. That is, part of our lives where we bring clear intention and we bring skills and we bring capacities to a particular situation. That's a huge part of our practice. You know, can you look to where some situations where that's hard now? You know? And can you say, I want to try to bring more equanimity to that area, you know? You know, I know for myself, for example, there have been certain family relationships that are very, very hard. And, you know, sometimes where it's very hard to keep centered or present, very easy to be reactive. And so can I take on that as part of my practice? You know, and each of us have some edge where it's really hard to be present, where we just get taken away. So the development of equanimity practice is to increasingly have more and more parts of our difficult experiences come into our practice. Again, we can do that with, again, ways that we're reactive. As I pointed out in the instructions at the beginning of the meditation, one of the ways that one of the places that we can really develop further in equanimity practice is to not just take challenging or difficult experiences where we're reactive, where we have difficult emotions or thoughts, but also increasingly start being aware of times when we actually get taken away by pleasant experiences. Those are typically not on our radar. You know, it's like, I'm in distress, meditation, please come to the rescue. Few of us say, I'm reactive by grabbing hold of something really pleasant. Meditation, come to the rescue. You know, help me from indulging for 3 days in a row in holiday suits. Yeah. Or whatever, or something where it's more pleasant. So that could be an edge of learning for many of us to, let's say for a week, start tracking pleasant experiences and see if you can be aware of those. I think I mentioned last week that experiment that I did with a group where I told them the problem isn't having pleasant experiences. The problem is our grabbing hold of pleasant experiences. Nothing wrong with pleasure. There is something problematic about grabbing hold of it and not being aware. And I told them, you know, we could just sit here all evening and have chocolate. And it could be a wonderful form of practice. And we actually, the next week, we did that. I think I mentioned that last week, didn't I? It's an interesting practice. Go into something really pleasant for you and watch whether you're reactive but grabbing hold of it. That's a more subtle form of cultivating equanimity, isn't it? Because again, we may often think of equanimity as being valuable, especially where we lose it or have something difficult, but it's also the case that we can cultivate equanimity with the harder stuff. With pleasant experiences. So I mentioned also that form of practice that is very traditional is in particular looking out for what are called the eight worldly winds. These are eight ways that we lose it. And interesting, these are four sets of one pleasant, one unpleasant experience. And we can get caught either way. So one form of equanimity practice is maybe writing down on your hand or your wall or somewhere these eight states and looking out for them. Pleasure and pain, gain and loss, you know, something good happening, something quote-unquote bad happening. Fame and disrepute, good reputation, bad reputation, good image, bad image. Someone says something, you know, nice about you. Someone says something critical of you. Where does your mind go? And then the fourth, similar, is praise and blame. Right? So this is a great way of cultivating equanimity. Stay alert to those eight different kinds of states for a week, or take it on for a month.
Could you repeat the third one? Sorry.
It's pleasure and pain, gain and loss, fame, what I'm calling fame and disrepute. Could be, you know, good image for others, bad image for others, something like that. And then the fourth is praise and blame. You know, very powerful. So that's giving us a little more precision in seeing areas that knock us around. I like the metaphor of the winds. You know, in the original text, it's the eight worldly conditions. I've heard the text of the winds come from Tibetan teachers, so maybe it's windier there. Windier in Tibet than in India. And so... and then the last practice we did to cultivate equanimity is more of a heart practice. Again, there are these two broad areas of ways to cultivate equanimity. One is more connected with mindfulness and wisdom, seeing clearly, and the other is connected with the heart, how we feel in relationship to ourself and others. And there are these variety of phrases that we can work with. And it can be quite powerful to do these practices for a sustained time. You know, I had one retreat where I practiced loving kindness, compassion, joy, and equanimity for a month. And I started by doing 2 days of equanimity practice, because I like the Tibetan model. When you're doing these, start with equanimity, because that brings in more strongly the wisdom dimension. So I did equanimity practice. You know, just for me, it was just going through a reference to different persons and saying, no matter what I wish for, things are as they are. And typically, when I would do that, I would say, no matter what I wish for, things are as they are. And, you know, with people close to me, you know, my mind would go to different things that I didn't like. Like when I did that psalm with my mother. This was probably, I think this was about 8 years ago that I did this retreat. And many of you know my mom died last year in February. And when I went to there, you know, my mind went to, you know, she was getting older, my mind went to her death. And I sort of sat with that, right? And that's what some of what happens, equanimity practice. I do it with myself. I would just, no matter what I wish for, things are as they are, and I just go, you know, oh, look at that. I don't like that. Or, and so it's a way of sort of being with that, but in the place of intentionally trying to be balanced. Yeah. So as we do these practices, I was mentioning this last time, we develop these different qualities. We develop more of a sense of balance. We can increasingly be balanced with whatever comes up. And again, a lot of the learning simply comes from opening to more and more experiences, so we have more, as it were, under our belt, or more experience. And so in our practice, we have at times in our meditation, in our daily life, we have hung out with this difficult state particularly, or that difficult state, with anger or fear or catastrophic thinking or whatever. And we just know these. Oh, I know, my mind goes there. And essentially, we can be with these challenging situations in a balanced way, without reacting, without actually making it worse. Oh, I have fear. Well, can I just be with it so I'm not afraid of fear or reactive towards fear or wanting the fear to leave? I can just be with it. A lot of this is to actually be able to be present with what's happening without further reaction. You know, many of you know the metaphor and the teaching of the two arrows. This would be without shooting the second arrow, meaning without making it worse. It's difficult enough. Can I not make it worse? Can I not be reactive? It's one of the glories of our practice, that we can simply be with what's challenging but not make it worse. Sometimes we can even make it better. But the main aim is to be with it, be present. And that only really comes from being willing to go into something difficult actually over and over again. It's where a lot of the learning occurs. And so if something occurs that's difficult in the next week, in the next month, can you say, I'm willing to go into this? I'm willing to be present. Again, we always want to remember the crucial distinction between knowing whether it's workable or whether it's not workable, whether it's too much or whether actually I can be present with this. Crucial distinction. Because in some situations, it's simply too much. And in those situations, it actually is not wise to imagine that we can be with it, because we can't. Right? So I may have some trauma from the past come up, but I can't really be with that. And I need to do something else which helps me move out of it, maybe. I can't really be mindful. So that distinction is crucial. But then, where something is in the relatively workable range, can I say, oh, here's something challenging? I notice my mind going into reaction or storytelling or negative narrative. Can I say, I'm willing to investigate that? I'm willing to work with it. Again, it could be through mindfulness. It could be through a kind of inquiry where you ask, you know, What's my mind doing now? Oh, it's going to this negative scenario. It's getting caught there. Oh, this this person is this way, and the relationship's always going to be like this, and you know, and besides, I'm right, and the other person is wrong, right? And so we can really notice those things and say, can I work with that? And sometimes the best way to work with it would be mindfulness. Sometimes the best way to work with it might be to do some inquiry, to look deeper, to see, you know, this is something that I've discussed some in the context of the work on transforming the judgmental mind. Sometimes we can actually see that there's something like a limiting belief or some semi-conscious or unconscious belief that's relatively unconscious often beneath the surface. And sometimes there are ways of inquiring. Maybe I'll bring in, it might be a good focus for a talk sometime to really see about working with that. You know, because that's crucial. How do we work with these half-conscious limiting beliefs that often rule us, at least when we're distressed in certain ways? So can we make that workable? So there's a sense of balance, there's a sense of evenness in relationship to what's occurring. These are some of what I covered last time. There can be a sense of increasingly unshakability is a quality of equanimity. You know, and there's a beautiful passage. Let me see if I have this here. One of them I might have read last week, but couldn't do so in the dark. From the Buddha to his son, Rahula. Rahula, develop meditation that is like the earth. For when you develop meditation that is like the earth, agreeable and disagreeable contacts will not invade your mind and remain. Just as people throw clean things and dirty things, excrement, urine, spittle, pus, and blood on the earth, and the earth is not horrified, humiliated, and disgusted because of that, so too, Rahula, develop meditation that is like the earth. For when you develop meditation that is like the earth, agreeable and disagreeable contacts will not invade your mind and remain. Of course, with that quote, we would have a little different perspective from ecologically, but still, you get the point, right? He's saying that can you be as solid as the earth and as equanimous as the earth, you know, not getting real upset, right, in that sense. Another quality of equanimity is understanding. There's an aspect of wisdom that really guides it, and that's why equanimity is so crucial in relationship to all experience, really, that it brings forth the wisdom of understanding the mind, also understanding causes and conditions, cause and effect, how things occur, knowing, you know, just knowing how one's mind works, maybe knowing how someone else's mind works, seeing things without being too caught in them, you know, and the person, Nyanaponikatera, who was a German monk who wrote the book The Heart of Buddhist Meditation, and wrote a beautiful essay called The Four Sublime States, which is on the website Access to Insight, which is about loving kindness, compassion, joy, and equanimity. He talks about equanimity as the inner center of the world. Mm-hmm. Beautiful phrase. And I think of that in relationship, some of you know, in Jewish tradition, there's the notion of the Lamed Vav. Do you know that? Some of you probably know that the Lamed Vav are the 36 just beings who actually keep the entire earth in balance. It's said that these are these beings that are awake, but a lot of them are very ordinary. It could be someone who just works at the grocery store. They're actually not generally known to be these great beings. So a lot of them are hidden. But there are these 36 beings that keep the earth in balance, right? And there's something like, they carry forth the equanimity function. So it's something like that. And there can also be, the fifth quality I wanted to mention is a sense of faith, that increasingly, as we develop equanimity, there's a sense of confidence, which is essentially confidence, this is workable. We expand our sense of being able to respond skillfully to more and more situations. That's what our practice does. And that's why, you know, I really want to encourage us, can I take a challenge that seems pretty much workable, can I actually lean into it rather than pull away from it? Because learning can occur. You know, can I take something difficult and not say, oh, darn. But can I actually say, oh, I want to go into this and explore this because I know that something's going to be learned. With the right attitude, I remember Jack Kornfield once said, fear, the presence of fear means that you're about to learn something. We're about to learn something. But it's only with the right attitude, right? All of these difficult states can say, oh, something to learn. But of course, our usual conditioning is to say, I wish this wasn't happening. Can we reverse that? Cultivating equanimity means to reverse that tendency. Can we do that? And last time I mentioned that there were two aspects of equanimity which are particularly challenging. One of them is that equanimity, because it carries wisdom, can, in a way, take us away from the heart. You know, and there's a long-standing split in Western culture, and I think we can see it also in Buddhist tradition, between the heart and the mind. And, you know, this is sometimes reflected in gender conditioning, you know, where women tend to bring forth the heart more, right? And we talked about that in various ways. But it's a long-standing split in Western culture that you know, that the mind, reason, wisdom isn't necessarily connected with the heart. And so one of the dangers of equanimity is that we would have a lot of equanimity, but the heart wouldn't fully be there. And this is pointed out in the traditional teachings by saying that the occupational hazard of equanimity is lapsing into indifference, where we don't really care. But I'm pretty balanced. I'm pretty balanced, but I'm a little bit aloof. I might be intellectually aloof. I might be removed from things, you know. And this is a danger for any of us who really like to cultivate wisdom, that the heart's not there. You know, I can totally personally identify with this. You know, that it's so it's really continually trying to connect the heart with our equanimity. That's why the heart practice, like if this is a danger for you, do a lot of loving kindness and compassion practice and do the equanimity practice as a heart practice. And try in different ways to really cultivate the heart. In many ways, if you just cultivate it, as well as cultivating the wisdom aspect of equanimity, they will tend to get integrated. Yeah. It's interesting because it's also, some of you may have felt, even in Buddhist tradition, there's a tension where the language of the heart and the language of wisdom look different. It's interesting. You know, so even in, you know, I mentioned this, I think, last time, but in loving kindness, we basically say, I wish this for you. I wish you well. And then with loving kindness, or with equanimity, we may say, no matter what you wish for, things are as they are. Take that. Right? And you can see the language a little bit different. You know, the language of loving kindness and compassion is quite personal. The language of wisdom tends to be impersonal. Things are just happening because of causes and conditions. How do we bring them together? Now, I think I wouldn't worry so much about doing that in a real logical way, but one way we do is we just are aware of that and we really cultivate both. Yeah. And as we do that, actually, if we're going to express it, our language actually starts to become more paradoxical. It's interesting. I think as we get really mature in this way, it's actually harder to express. because the language of just talking more impersonally in the wisdom mode doesn't work so well. And the language of just talking personally in the compassion, loving kindness mode doesn't work so well. So if you have friends or you find yourself saying, I can't quite express that, or I feel myself drawn to paradox, could be a very good sign. Okay, and the second challenge particularly that I mentioned last time is that, again, equanimity has the occupational hazard of going into indifference, which has both a hard aspect, but it also can be removed from action. You know, it can be not so responsive. It can be, again, aloof, indifferent. And true equanimity is both balanced and responsive. And I was thinking of that partly in relationship to this theme of darkness, which we are moving into. And I think it's really crucial, not crucial, but it's a very powerful time now in multiple religious traditions, multiple spiritual traditions, this time of the greatest darkness in the Northern Hemisphere. And it can be a wonderful time to, through the lens of darkness and light, practice equanimity. That there's a way that can be very helpful in the time around the winter solstice to give some quiet time at this very special time of greatest darkness. Can you give some quiet time? I love the fact that about 12, 13 years ago, I and my friends John Travis and Heather Sundberg, we had the idea of starting a retreat at Spirit Rock around the winter solstice. On the schedule, there wasn't anything there. And we said, people will be really busy. No one will, you know, maybe we'll have, you know, full retreat at Spirit Rock was like 80 people. And we said, maybe we'll have 30 or 40 come, but that'll be okay. We'll have a good time. And we'll focus on really having this quiet time at the winter solstice. And essentially, 12, 13 years, retreat's been full every year. And we've actually, certainly the last 5 or 8 years, we have a waiting list starting in November. People really want to come. And we have a great time. We probably, how many of you have done that retreat? Probably several of you, yeah. We have a great time. We focus on the themes of darkness and light. Sometimes we turn off all the lights and sit in the dark. We have a winter solstice ceremony. It'll be on the 21st. But we also emphasize ways to make this period into a period of practice. And one of them is by really looking at this sense of darkness and light. And darkness can mean a lot of things. You know, one of the things it can mean, is that like the earth, it can be a time, at least some of the time, to stop, to settle, to not move so much. Of course, in the larger culture, everyone's moving frenetically. Can I take some of this time, at least, to be more quiet, to tune into my own being? And another way that the theme of darkness can play out is that darkness can be understood metaphorically as a time of not knowing. Right? Can I open to not knowing? To connect with equanimity, can I use this time to cultivate more equanimity where I don't know what's happening? That's a whole practice in itself. I think it can be a practice that we open to at this time. Or can you take times that you don't know and use them as times of practice and times when equanimity can be developed? This is from the poet Rilke. I love the dark hours of my being. My mind deepens into them. There I can find, as in old letters, the days of my life already lived and held like a legend and understood. Then the knowing comes. I can open to another life that's wide and timeless. But there's a sense that for that knowing to come out of unknowing, we have to be equanimous with the unknowing. Can we do that? Is there some part of your life that you're not clear about, which is unresolved or unsatisfactory? Can you be with the unknowing? With that, not easy. Can you be with the darkness? I've been thinking about this theme some with my friend Marisa Handler, with whom I'm going to teach this day long on the dark night of the soul, or the dark night. And it's a very powerful theme, because there's sometimes periods in our lives where we go into a kind of not knowing for a sustained time. Probably some of us have had those experiences, right? Where there's a kind of not knowing disorientation. And these are particularly spoken about in a spiritual context by some of the Christian mystics. Some of you may have read St. John of the Cross, wrote the book called Dark Night of the Soul in the 16th century. And he is interesting, because he said that to enter into this dark night of not knowing, where everything actually becomes, for in a certain way, meaningless. He says it's actually a more advanced stage of spiritual development. Beginners don't go into that. But it's at a certain point where maybe spiritual life has been pretty satisfying and stable, but then it's not so meaningful. And one goes into a kind of aridity, dryness. And this is actually, he says, it's like being weaned, moving away from something that was more ordinary and less mature. And of course, one doesn't like being weaned. And so there can be disorientation, fear, reaction, but actually something deeper is coming, and eventually there's a kind of knowing that comes out of that. But there's a kind of a dark night of not knowing that can be there for some of us for periods of time. And again, imagine that a number of us have had shorter or longer periods of that, or they can sometimes be quite short but very intense, right? And I'm thinking also that collectively, I think we're entering into a kind of dark night of the culture, of the society, of the world, right? Because part of the dark night is that you actually don't know that there's going to be a happy ending. It's possible that there won't. There won't be. And I think there's a way, I think for me the metaphor of the dark night is helpful for looking at what's happening in our world. Can we have both the action and responsiveness that's necessary, but also equanimity when things are fearful in many ways, and when we don't know what's going to happen? Can we have equanimity? Can we have balance, but also that responsiveness? In other words, mature equanimity. And so I think, again, the metaphor of the dark night can point towards one of the ways that we practice both individually and collectively. To me, it's a helpful metaphor, and it's a lot to say that we're collectively going into a dark night, but I think it's true, and we don't even know that the species will survive, right? If we're honest, we don't know that for sure. Certainly, if we keep on doing what we've been doing, we won't. Can we turn it around? Again, not a matter of, on the issue of something like climate change, not an issue of how to do it, it's just an issue of political will. We know very well what to do, or many people do. But anyway, does that make some sense? That's kind of like a collective dark night. And so developing the capacity to be both equanimous and responsive, which again I'm saying is part of mature equanimity, is a crucial capacity for us both individually and in the collective context. If all of you develop this tremendous, more and more mature equanimity, You're what's needed. We're what's needed in the world as well as individually. You know, and then there's that. So there's that sense of darkness as not knowing, and darkness, in a related way, darkness as difficult, is part of what we can look into. Can I open, as in the equanimity practice, to what's difficult? And then the other aspect of darkness I wanted to mention is that the darkness is ultimately, when we stay with it, is fertile, generative, like the earth, which goes into the most darkness. But we know that, you know, a lot of stuff's happening beneath the surface, right? You know, like with those plants are getting ready to bud, but we can't see it, right? But we can have a certain faith. And so that's related to the faith that we may have in a way, or something that keeps us have some degree of balance during something like a dark night. Yeah. In the text by St. John of the Cross, the dark night does lead, when we stay with it, it leads to a kind of a knowing. And it leads to what he called illumination, and sort of taking in of the sacred in a more mature way. But we need the equanimity to stay with those dark periods. Maybe the last aspect of deepening in equanimity that I wanted to mention is that partly what we also develop as we do this equanimity practice is a consciousness which is bigger and bigger, an awareness which is bigger and bigger, which can hold more and more, which can just be increasingly with experiences and in a way hold them. And this can, I think, first be cultivated in meditation or meditative types of practices, where we open to, in a sense, an awareness that's actually beyond our personal awareness. We're open to something beyond the individual. You know, what is pointed to in Buddhist traditions and other traditions as this kind of subjectless, objectless awareness, which is wise, which is compassionate, and which is responsive, but has a vastness to it. And I think I talk about this from time to time, and in some of my advanced retreats, we develop that kind of awareness. But I wanted just to invoke that and say that that is also something that we develop in our meditation practice, that kind of awareness which can hold more and more, in a sense, in meditation, not take it personally, not be reactive. And I wanted to end with one of my favorite expressions of this kind of vast awareness. This is from the Thai teacher Achan Cha, okay? The very playful, mischievous teacher that I got to study with, who is from Thailand, and he died about 25 years ago, and was the teacher of Jack Kornfield and Achan Sumedho. And he likened this large awareness to being in a room and opening the windows. And he said this, he called this the one seat where everything happens. And think of this as both invoking a large awareness, but also as an image of equanimity. Okay, here it is, and I'll end with this. So I'm gonna just be pointing to this large awareness. Maybe another session I can focus on it in more depth. I know it's interesting to, important for many of us. Just go into the room and put one chair in the center. This is the description of equanimity practice, okay? Take the seat in the center of the room, open the doors and windows, and see who comes to visit. You will witness all kinds of scenes and actors, all kinds of temptations and stories imaginable. Your only job is to stay in your seat. You will see it all arise and pass, and out of this, wisdom and understanding will come. We could say equanimity. As I see it, the mind is like a single point, the center of the universe, and mental states are like visitors who come to stay at this point for short or long periods of time. Get to know these visitors well. Become familiar with the vivid pictures they paint, the alluring stories they tell to entice you to follow them. But do not give up your seat. It is the only chair around. So this is the seat of staying present, being mindful. It is the only chair around. If you continue to occupy it unceasingly, greeting each guest as it comes, firmly establishing yourself in awareness, transforming your mind into the one who knows. This is his phrase for this large awareness. Being the one who knows. The one who is awake, the visitors will eventually stop coming back. If you give them real attention, how many times can these visitors return? Speak with them here and you will know every one of them well. Then your mind will at last be in peace. An image of equanimity. So equanimity is ultimately connected in its most mature form with compassion, with responsiveness, also with a vastness, a vastness of awareness that can be more and more there with whatever comes, simply knowing what comes and goes in experience, being compassionate, responsive, and wise. That's one of the ways of understanding the aim of our practice. Thank you. And any thoughts, questions, reflections, spontaneous poems? Please. Do we use the mic? Okay.
My mind's reeling a little bit with questions, but what I'd like to ask you is, one of the things that you didn't talk about was the foreboding nature of darkness. That side of darkness, which I think is mystically considered the evil side, or would you talk a little bit about that and how that fits into this, or is that covered by equanimity?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In Buddhist tradition, there's not really a sense of evil. Right? The deep source of suffering and confusion is ignorance. Right? And so, which you find in some traditions, with a certain degree of incoherence, postulate evil, but don't want to make it too independent, because then what about God's omniscience? So it gets a little incoherent when you look at notions of evil in Christianity or Islam or Judaism. So there's... But generally speaking, we could say, but I think the spirit of what you're asking would be, the darkness... the darkness of the human soul, or the darkness of destructive actions, the darkness of seeing so much violence or so much suffering, right? And so how do we take that in and still have equanimity? And it's one way of saying your question.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I think it's similar that we, some of us will choose to go into that. Sometimes we don't have a choice, right, in our lives. And many of us are blessed to not necessarily have the kind of experiences that other people at other times in other cultures have in terms of the whole society, Think of if you were in Syria, right? Or, I don't know, in the Holocaust, or, you know, living in the U.S. at the time of the Civil War, right? You know, that where violence and that kind of suffering is so widespread. So some of us know that, some at a distance, right? At some distance. But again, it can be a question, if some people feel called to know that better, right? And some of us, again, may face that maybe in some of our work. You know, some people I know who are psychotherapists work with some of that. I know one person who does testimony in court related to a lot of sexual abuse, right? And so encounters a lot of that, you know, this up close, right? So I think it's a matter of, but I think a mature understanding of human beings has to take that into account, really. And so I think it's part, you know, how can we may want consciously to explore that. And I think we need to do that somewhat just to know ourselves. I think, you know, we've looked, for example, in some of our sessions into questions of race and racism in the history. And I think to know oneself in this country, one has to explore that territory and know that, you know, and know that history and go into the really difficult territory. You know, I was, in November, in Washington, D.C., mostly visiting relatives and doing some teaching. And I went to two museums, and they were the Museum of African American History and Culture and the Holocaust Museum. The Holocaust Museum, partly because I wanted to complete something from my travels to Israel. I'd already been there, but, you know, both of those, you know, took one into territory that we're what we're talking about there. So I think it's important to go into there, and how to go into there, so you take it as a kind of equanimity practice, so you stay balanced, and, you know, it's not helpful to take in too much where it's overwhelming. So again, some of us may go into that by choice and some of us not by choice. But I think it's important to do so skillfully and have tools. And it is part, I think it is part of what we could mean by darkness. So thank you. Yeah, please. Right next to you. Yeah.
Echoing, thank you very much. I deeply hope that the recording works and that we can listen to it more than one time. Mm.
Yeah.
Really rich. One of the images that I'm struck by is the light that you shine on other wisdom practices, mm-hmm. through what you're describing. So, for example, in the last reading, I'm reminded, as other people probably were, about Rumi's guest house.
Mm-hmm.
And also Rupert Spira, whom some of us have heard, has a one line, which I won't remember exactly, but it's imagine station through which many trains come and go.
Mm.
Be like the station, not like the trains.
Mm-hmm.
I've been recently setting the Kabbalah,
mm-hmm.
And I'm struck by the top of the Sefirot, the 10 characteristics or the emanations of the infinite, from nothingness or no thingness. The top two are the same that you describe.
Mm.
On the one hand is wisdom, and on the other hand is compassion.
Mm-hmm.
And from those two, everything
else. Yeah, beautiful.
So it's our window into the infinite, because we can't really know the infinite in the Kabbalah tradition. So I wonder whether you think that it's a distortion to try to think about equanimity in that way, that equanimity is a light that allows us to begin to approach a little bit more of the infinite,
mm-hmm.
that is otherwise beyond comprehension?
No, I think it's very nicely said that I mentioned in Buddhist tradition, equanimity is always presented as the most advanced quality in several series of qualities, several of the lists. And it is often seen as quite close to the sacred, to Nibbana. And so I think that's helpful. And you can even see the way I was interpreting equanimity in one very mature form as like this vast awareness. And, you know, in a lot of Buddhist traditions, that, again, they don't use the language of the divine, but that kind of vast awareness is where one touches the, again, it's a little more explicit in Tibetan tradition, but where one touches actually the nature of reality, the nature of things, and it's actually a... the nature of things is no thingness, so to speak. And so I think it's very similar to what you're describing in terms of the Kabbalah. It was interesting. I don't know if I mentioned this when I talked about having gone to Israel, but when I was there, I spent time in the center of Kabbalah in Israel, which is a small city called Sfat. And I met with several Kabbalistic rabbis, and we shared notes. It was fun. And I also met with one in Jerusalem, and it was nice back and forth. So I think there are parallels, you know, and mature equanimity is a wisdom quality, but it also, as we've seen, has to have that quality of compassion. And I think when it gets into its more mature forms, again, if you connect it with what I was talking about with St. John of the Cross, which is Christian tradition, there is a way that dark night empties out the one who goes through it so much that it actually can be filled by the divine. That's how it is in that tradition. And so I think there are parallels between what we're talking about, Buddhist tradition, Christian tradition, at least the Christian mystical tradition, in terms of the way it manifested in Spain and with St. John of the Cross and Teresa of Avila and the Kabbalah, you know, which they did have some actually. Kabbalah and, you know, the Christian mystical traditions did have connections. Right? I think St. John of the Cross had Jewish ancestry in part. Yeah, he was treading on thin water. He actually spent time in prison because he had Jewish and Muslim ancestry in part, and he got in trouble with the Inquisition some. Anyway, that's another story. So thank you. I think we've gone over a little bit. So what I want to ask you before we read the meta cards is just check in right now to your intention coming out of our evening. Some of you may want to practice equanimity a little bit more for the next week, or be inspired in some way. So see what's there for you.